Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and we're continuing our walk through Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. And we're focusing today on a chapter in her book where she takes on the big question of whether natural marriage is even worth saving. But before we begin, let me again give our new listeners a quick review of our earlier programs. First, we began by talking about what we as conservatives believe and what we are for, rather than just what we are against. Put simply, we want to conserve from our rich heritage all that is good. Second, we talked about the importance of tone and civility in all of our conversations, especially on the hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. And that also means we need to listen to each other. Third, we stressed the importance of making decisions on what we know to be true and good, rather than on our feelings and emotions, which often get us into trouble by telling us, if it feels good, do it. Fourth, we reviewed how conservatism is built on our Judeo-Christian heritage and how that helped our founding fathers create the constitutional system of limited government that we still enjoy today. Fifth, we moved into some specific hot-button issues. For example, who does a better job of caring for the poor? Liberals or conservatives? Well, you might be surprised at what we discovered. Next was about our religious liberty. The Constitution specifically protects our religious freedoms from government control. But when those rights are challenged by other groups, who wins? Seventh, that took us to another hot debate that we talked about last week involving a conflict between competing rights. Now, this is the question, these competing rights. Does an unborn baby have the right to live, or do the mother and her doctor have the right to take that life away? Well, that's the background, and that brings us to today's question of whether natural marriage is worth saving. But before we begin, some of you might still be asking what qualifies Rita or anyone else to take on this daunting task of restoring America's soul. Well, as I've been saying for weeks now, she's a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. She's worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute, allied attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom, and now national legislative strategist for the Convention of States Project. She's a syndicated columnist for numerous media outlets, including her weekly column for the Daily News Record. And, of course, she is the co-host of our weekly Crossroads program. So with that, Rita, I know everybody's interested in this book. I wonder if you could tell listeners where they can get a copy of it.
Sure. I want to encourage our local listeners to head on down to Blessings Christian Bookstore, located at 313 Neff Avenue, right here in Harrisonburg. They have copies of the book, and I encourage you to support them by getting your book there, because Blessings is a sponsor of our Crossroads program. If you're not local or can't make it out to Blessings Christian Bookstore, you can also get a copy on Amazon online. And Dean, before we dive into this, I just want to make a quick clarification. I just want to say Rita on her own is not even going to make a dent in restoring America's soul. But the hope is that Rita, along with all of my Christian brothers and sisters and the church and everybody who cares about these issues, I hope that together we can make a difference for our country. And I hope that this book will serve to give people some guidelines and suggestions for how to do that. Just wanted to clarify.
That did sort of put the whole load on you, didn't it, Rita?
Yeah, that's quite a load.
Frankly, we just really do appreciate our listeners who come in repeatedly thanking us for taking on these issues from a biblical point of view.
It's so encouraging.
Yeah, and this is a big one, Rita, just like the one last week about the sanctity of life. And again, I'm hoping that all of our listeners will agree with everything that we say today, but I know that we've all had different experiences with this issue of marriage, which may have led some of us to different conclusions. Now, for example, and again, I'll give up my personal experience and yours. I know you have experienced difficult marriages and instances of divorce among members of your family, as I have. In addition, some of us have friends or relatives who've moved into same-sex relationships or even into so-called marriages. The world is changing rapidly, and we have a very different culture today in its views about marriage from the one we grew up in. And therefore, some of our listeners may be asking as we go through this program whether natural marriage is already becoming obsolete. But despite these changes, Rita, there is one thing I know that has not changed. The Bible has not changed, and it is very clear what it says about God's design for marriage. In Genesis, for example, it starts out by saying that God created man and woman in his own image, and he then commanded them to be fruitful and multiply, to replenish the earth and have dominion over it. And therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother, cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh for the purpose of multiplying and having family. Jesus then confirmed this later in the book of Matthew when he added that whatsoever God has joined together in marriage, he's meaning, no man shall separate or put asunder. Other scriptures make this so clear as well, including repeated and very clear commandments against sexual relationships outside of marriage or particularly with other members of the same sex. What say you about
that? Well, you're absolutely right. And I really appreciate you laying the scriptural foundation for this issue, because for any Christian who might be tempted to say, well, this is a moot point now because we have same-sex marriage in our country, this is why that's the wrong way to think about it. For the Christian, this will never be a moot point.
Not everybody will accept scripture as authority, but there are practical reasons for continuing to maintain our belief in natural marriage. In this chapter in this book, you started off with an interesting quote from Sharif Girgis. It says, and I'll just quote from that section, "The greater battle is not one that our temporal opponents can make us lose. It is won if we stay on the field and lost if we flee." So who is this Sharif Girgis, and why did you choose this quote?
Well, I think this quote is so poignant given the state of marriage in our law and culture today. I know, again, that a lot of readers will come to this chapter with that mindset. Why are we even talking about this? The Supreme Court has already decided this question, and now we all have to live with same-sex marriage. Shouldn't we just move on? But the thing is, as I said before, the Christian can never just move on, because it is our duty to be lights in the darkness, to be witnesses of the truth. And the truth on this issue is, God designed the institution of marriage, and he has the ultimate say in what marriage is and what it isn't. Now, the quote comes from a book that does an amazing job of setting forth the case for natural marriage. And let me just give you the quote again. "The greater battle is not one that our temporal opponents can make us lose. It is won if we stay on the field and lost if we flee." And when I read that, it's a reminder to me that our job as Christians in this culture at this time is to continue to carry the banner of truth and to advocate for an understanding of marriage consistent with God's definition of marriage, because anything else is going to turn out badly. And the book, I just want to mention, it's such a good book. There are actually three authors, Sharif Girgis, Ryan Anderson, and Robbie George. It's pretty intellectual, but so powerful. And it's called The Case for Marriage, Man and Woman, A Defense. It's an excellent book. And anyone who really wants to do some in-depth study of this, I encourage you to check it out.
Those are some of the best thinkers and writers in America today on these issues. Now, moving on, what would have happened if we had taken the Supreme Court decision on the Dred Scott case?
Yeah.
Well, let's just move on. They're slaves. They're just property. the Supreme Court has decided, let's just move on. We can't do that. And I really like this quote, Rita, because it reminds me of something we often say in our work with the Valley Family Forum. We won't give up. We won't give in. And we will not quit until we win.
And we know that ultimately God's way wins.
Truth wins.
Yep.
But now let's go on to the next section of the chapter. You're a little tough on us Christians, Rita, when you talk about the fact that the church hasn't always been a faithful witness of the kind of marriage that is described in the Bible.
Yes, I am a bit tough on us. And I think it's important to note that this chapter on marriage is not just about how the institution of marriage has been redefined by the courts in recent years. It's not just a chapter about same-sex marriage, because the erosion of marriage started long ago. I don't think there's any way of escaping that truth.
I'd like to escape, Rita, because you go so far as to call us marriage schizophrenics.
It's tough love, Dean.
Okay.
It seems to me that much of the conservative movement, including much of the church in America, has been really inconsistent in our enthusiasm for protecting the institution of marriage. And specifically, it seems like we've been willing to let certain trends slide for many years. But then when the issue of gay marriage started sweeping the nation, all of a sudden we were all zealots to protect marriage. I think, Dean, that we need to repent of our willingness to turn a blind eye to the sins that we can relate to, but then to pounce on the ones that we believe are beyond our own temptations or inclinations.
Okay, Rita, I plead guilty. Because when a wrong is to my advantage to ignore, it's no longer a wrong. I can somehow justify it. It brings back a memory of some years ago when the Valley Family Forum held a program to warn against the growing acceptance of homosexuality. And at that time, I distinctly remember saying that we are suffering from a case of AIDS when it comes to the issue of marriage. And what I meant by that is that we had become so indifferent to the harm that we were doing to marriage in our acceptance of cohabitation before marriage, to extramarital affairs, and to even divorce, that the great institution of marriage, natural marriage, was no longer immune to the viruses, forms of compromises, and attacks against it from, specifically, the homosexual lobby. But you actually address this in your book, Rita, when you mention four specific erosions of the institution of marriage in our culture. First, you say that marriage has become optional, and you're talking here, I believe, about the high incidence of cohabitation and sex before marriage?
That's right. And Dean, I want to pause for a minute and say that I think you were the one who first introduced me to these changes in the way we view the institution of marriage in our society. And as you said, that first one is, what did we call it?
Optional. Yes.
Yeah. Now that sex outside of marriage has become the norm, people have lost one of the most obvious incentives for getting married and staying married. And when I say sex outside of marriage has become the norm, yeah, we might hear parents say, yeah, I want my child to wait until marriage, but there's no longer that normative expectation that that is the way it is, and that is the only right way to do it.
Well, Rita, we've talked a number of times throughout this series how much the world has changed, and this is just another example. I remember when we were growing up, we were taught something very simple, keep yourself pure. And we knew exactly what that meant. But you also say that marriage has become self-centered. What do you mean by self-centered?
This is a big one, and it's more abstract, but every bit as important. We live in a culture with an entitlement mentality. We're taught from childhood to follow our dreams, to pursue our happiness, to satisfy ourselves, to self-actualize. We no longer hear so much about the commitment of marriage and why that is a beautiful, positive thing. We no longer hear that much about sacrifice are about sticking it out through tough times. The prevailing attitude seems to be that marriage is all about making me happy. And that is deadly. That attitude is deadly to marriage.
It hurts me personally because I know of a man who divorced his wife of over 40 years because, in his very words, she no longer makes me happy. That was particularly painful because it created a breach within his own family that has never healed and is not likely to ever heal. But the second trend that you mentioned, clearly related to that first one, is that marriage has become disposable. I am assuming you're talking about divorce.
Yes. Divorce, as we know, has become commonplace. It's not even that big of a deal, it seems, anymore. And of course, there are times when divorce is necessary in cases of physical abuse and that sort of thing. But what we have now is commonplace casual divorce. And this trend has had a tragic impact on every aspect of our society. It's the breakdown of the family, Dean, which we know has not only harmful effects on the kids and their educational success, it has a harmful effect on the economy, and particularly for women and their economic achievement. Divorce has just become a disease in our society.
Rita, the thought has just occurred to me that this casual divorce really goes back to cohabitation. If you can move from one hookup to another hookup to another hookup, what difference does it make whether you're married?
Right.
You just keep on going with that same life.
Well, and it's related to the marriage becoming self-centered. It's just like the man you described. If it's all about me and my spouse is not making me happy, why shouldn't I get divorced? And I mentioned that we don't hear that much anymore about the beauty and virtue of self-sacrifice and commitment and sticking it out through the hard times. We used to hear people talk about staying together for the kids because they're married. Maybe they're not in bliss anymore, but they're going to stay together for the kids. And today, when you hear that phrase, staying together for the kids, it's almost always in a negative context. Like, that's somehow a bad thing to stay together for the kids.
Happiness.
Right.
I've said about all I have to say about that, except to say that there's a study that's been done. This might be an encouragement to our listeners. Many people who have been considering divorce, have gone to marriage counselors, have decided to stay with it, end up happier after 5 years of that than the one who went the divorce route.
That's very encouraging.
There is encouragement and hope ahead. You also said in your last item that marriage has become redefinable, and I suppose we're talking about the most recent trend in our culture today.
That's right. The recent Supreme Court decision, that was 2015, declaring a fundamental right to same-sex marriage is exactly that. It's a redefinition of what marriage is. But let's pause for just a minute and think about the cumulative effect of the other three trends. The fact is that we've now accepted a separation of marriage and sex. They no longer required to go together. We've begun thinking about marriage as a tool for our personal pleasure and fulfillment. And we've largely accepted divorce as a legitimate choice for a spouse to make when his marriage no longer brings him fulfillment. So you see, we had already been tinkering with the functional definition of marriage for decades. The advent of same-sex marriage is really just a formal extension of that redefinition that we had already been working on.
Well, Rita, we've got a whole package here, and let's just now sort of try to bring it all together. And as you point out, it's still important for us to be able to persuasively advocate for natural marriage because, again, our job is to carry the banner of truth. And to that end, you address three primary arguments that led to the acceptance of same-sex marriage. So let's just go through those.
Okay. Well, the first one is this idea that same-sex marriage is merely an expansion of marriage. That is incorrect. The only way we can consider same-sex unions as marriage is to redefine marriage, to change what it means. And I think it's important to pause here and point out that even if we put aside what the Bible says about marriage, The whole reason the government ever got into the business of recognizing and sanctioning and licensing marriage was because the government has an interest in providing incentives for the type of union that nurtures children best. And that is a one man, one woman, exclusive permanent union. It is in the best interest of society to provide an incentive for the man and woman whose union results in children to stick together and raise those children. It's best for the children. It's best for everyone. And Dean, many experts have noted that in this regard, this definition is especially beneficial to women because the burden of raising children tends to fall disproportionately on women.
I can't disagree, Rita, but how do you respond to same-sex partners who claim that they're as capable as a man and a woman in raising a child?
I'd say, Dean, every child needs a mother and a father. And it's a tragic reality that sometimes that can't be the case for whatever reason, death, divorce, whatever. But we owe it to children as the adults in society to provide as many incentives as we can for the natural parents to stick together and raise their children together.
Well, Rita, I think you and I can both testify from our own experiences. Men and women have differing gifts.
Yes.
And you bring these gifts together for the benefit of the child.
Labeling same-sex unions as marriage requires a definite shift from objective characteristics, gender and age, for instance, to subjective characteristics. If you really think about it, under this new definition, you're just marrying your favorite person, whoever you are most emotionally connected to. There's no longer this objective set of criteria for what a marriage is.
Rita, that is a joke. And by that I mean, it reminds me of the signs that I used to see everywhere at same-sex marriage rallies. Marry who you love.
I know, I hate those signs.
Well, when I saw people carrying those signs, I just couldn't help myself. I had to go up to them and ask if it would be all right for me to marry my daughter, who I love very much. Or how about the right to marry multiple women or even other men? The only answer I ever got was a dirty look that just told me to go away. But it's true.
Yeah.
It is not a basis for marriage. But another powerful argument we heard was that same-sex marriage was about ending discrimination and achieving marriage equality. How do you respond to that?
It's a fallacy, Dean. Discrimination, or the bad kind of discrimination, is when you treat two people differently who are not different in any relevant sense. But when it comes to same-sex couples, the fact is that they are different from heterosexual couples in a way that is directly relevant to what marriage is and why the state recognizes it.
Well, you offer a couple of analogies on this in your book, which I think are very helpful. For example, you talk about medical degrees. We only give those degrees to doctors who've passed the exams, completed the coursework. That's not discrimination, at least not in a bad way.
That's right. We're just maintaining qualifications that have to do with the reason the government regulates the practice of medicine in the first place. And the same was true when marriage was limited to a man and a woman.
You also go on to define marriage as a one man, one woman union, all about telling people whom they can love.
Well, it kind of goes back to what you said about the signs. And this one is actually upsetting to me. If you really think about it, Dean, this idea reduces love to one single type of relationship that involves sex. And I find that offensive. It also turns the whole issue on its head. A conservative would be the first one to say that the government has no business handing out licenses for love. Why do we need the government to do that? Again, the reason the government has an interest in regulating marriage is because it is the one and only type of relationship that is directly connected to childbearing and child rearing.
Well, Rita, you've pointed out very effectively things that we've done wrong to allow this to happen. But what can we do to get it back on track?
Well, I want to say first, we have to be consistent in the way we talk about marriage and the way we understand marriage. And this goes back to what we talked about in the beginning. We have to have in ourselves the right attitude about marriage. It's not all about me and my happiness, and it's not disposable. It's not optional. I think that's the most important thing. And beyond that, I think we need to just continue to learn how to make a persuasive and winsome case for why natural marriage is worth conserving.
Well, Rita, one thing really stands out in my memory, and you were a part of this. You remember what we did in 2006. There was a proposed marriage amendment for the voters to approve or disapprove that would amend the Virginia Constitution to define marriages between only one man and one woman. That included putting up yard signs all over the area. It was also the case of Luis Padilla, who got fired from Cargill for putting a sign on the back of his truck urging people to vote for marriage. Now, that was a clear example of what we discussed several years ago. It was a conflict between his right to speech and religious expression or the contrary right of an LGBT activist not to be offended by his beliefs. But it was about standing up for natural marriage. You remember how that came out?
I remember we got involved and he got his job back.
Yes. We took on Cargill and they agreed. They backed down and rehired him. So that was an example of something we can do and must continue to do. It includes supporting our pro-marriage Virginia legislators, who even today are constantly called on to defend our laws against attacks on natural marriage. Well, Rita, we just have time left for your elevator speech. Go for it.
Marriage is the most fundamental relationship of society, so how we view and define it is incredibly important. The reason for government-regulated marriage is to encourage stable, permanent families in which, whenever possible, children are raised by both of their biological parents. This has proven to be best for children. Our culture and public policies have undermined marriage for a long time by sanctioning sex outside of marriage and by facilitating quick, easy divorce. Changing the definition of marriage to enable same-sex couples to marry also damages the institution by severing it from its purpose of creating a permanent bond between a mother, a father, and their children. While I understand the desire of same-sex couples to have their relationship endorsed by government, the toll this takes on society, which is the beneficiary of children being raised by both their natural parents, is just too high. By destroying the special status that society once reserved for mothers and fathers committed to raising a family together, we devalue the great benefit this particular arrangement confers upon society, thus making it less likely that mothers and fathers will make the sacrifices required to stick together and serve as a stabilizing influence for their children and for society as a whole.
Well, Rita, we're out of time, but thank you so much for walking through this with us. If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Rita Dunaway about her new book, Restoring America's Soul. And again, I would encourage all of you to get a copy of it from Blessings Christian Bookstore located at 313 Neff Avenue here in Harrisonburg. Now, we'd like to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Dental Practice of Scott Dunaway, Blessings Christian Bookstore, and others. And we also want to thank so many of you for your financial support. Finally, we're deeply grateful for your prayers and encouragement. For example, we have a letter from Donna who says, "Thank you so much for constantly looking for relevant issues to discuss from a biblical worldview. You are all heroes in my book." So, thank you, Donna. And once again, we want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.